blind, can't see a thing in the world. As it turns out, though, he is able to see things in the spirit and divine world, can see the truth of what's actually happened, truth to which our hero is utterly oblivious. The blind specialist gets into a heated argument with the protagonist, who accuses the specialist of fraud, and is accused in turn of being the worst sort of malefactor, one who, by the way, is blind to what really matters. What did this fellow do? Nothing much. Just murder his father and marry his mother. 2.5 millennia ago, Sophocles wrote a little play called Oedipus Rex. Tiresias, the blind seer, does indeed know the whole truth about King Oedipus, sees everything, although that knowledge is so painful that he tries to hold it back. And when he does blurt it out, it is in a moment of such anger that no one believes him. Oedipus, meanwhile, who until the very end remains in the dark, makes constant reference to sight. He will bring the matter to light, will look into things, will show everyone the truth. Every time he says one of these things, the audience gasps and squirms in its seats, because we see what's going on long before he does. When he finally sees the horror that is his life, children who are also siblings, a wife, mother, driven to suicide, a curse like no other on him and his family, he exacts a terrible punishment indeed. He blinds himself. There are a lot of things that have to happen when a writer introduces a blind character into a story, and even more in a play. Every move, every statement by or about that character has to accommodate the lack of sight. Every other character has to notice, to behave differently, if only in subtle ways. In other words, the author has created a minor constellation of difficulties for himself by introducing a blind character into the work. So something important must be at stake when blindness pops up in a story. Clearly, the author wants to emphasize other levels of sight and blindness beyond the physical. Moreover, such references are usually quite pervasive in a work where insight and blindness are at issue. For example, first-time readers or viewers will observe that Tiresias is blind but sees the real story, and Oedipus is blind to the truth and eventually blinds himself. What they may miss, though, is the much more elaborate pattern running through the fabric of the play. Every scene, it seems, every ode by the chorus, contains references to seeing. Who saw what? Who failed to see? Who is really blind? And images of light and darkness, which have everything to do with seeing or not seeing. More than any other work, Oedipus Rex taught me how to read literary blindness, taught me that as soon as we notice blindness and sight as thematic components of a work, more and more related images and phrases emerge in the text. The challenging thing about literature is finding answers, but equally important is recognizing what questions need to be asked, and if we pay attention, the text usually tells us. I didn't always know to look for the right questions. I grew into asking. Coming back to blindness, I distinctly remember the first time I read James Joyce's little story, Araby. The first line tells us that the street the young narrator lives on is blind. I thought, that's an odd expression. I promptly got hung up on what it meant in the literal sense. A blind alley in British/Irish English is a dead-end street, which has another set of connotations, some related and some not, and missed entirely what it really meant. I got most of the story, the boy watching the girl at every opportunity, even when the light is poor or he has the blinds, I'm not making this up, pulled almost all the way down, the boy blinded by love, then by vanity, the boy envisioning himself as a hero out of a romance, the boy going to the supposedly exotic bazaar Araby, arriving late to find much of it already in darkness, registering it as the tawdry and anti-romantic place that it is, and finally, the boy, nearly blinded by his own angry tears, seeing himself for the ridiculous creature he is. I think I had to read the story 2 more times before I got hooked into North Richmond Street being blind. The significance of that adjective isn't immediately evident or relevant in itself. What it does, though, is set up a pattern of reference and suggestion as the young boy watches, hides, peeks, and gazes his way through a story that is alternately bathed in light and lost in shadow. Once we ask the right question, something like, what does Joyce intend by calling the street blind? Answers begin presenting themselves with considerable regularity. A truly great story or play, as Araby and Oedipus Rex are, makes demands on us as readers. In a sense, it teaches us how to read it. We feel that there's something more going on in the story, a richness, a resonance, a depth, than we picked up at first. So we return to it to find those elements that account for that sensation. Periodically throughout this book, I have felt obliged to issue disclaimers. This is one of those times. What we have discussed is absolutely true. When literal blindness, sight, darkness, and light are introduced into a story, it is nearly always the case that figurative seeing and blindness are at work. Here's the caveat. Seeing and blindness are generally at issue in many works, even when there is no hint of blindness on the part of windows, alleys, horses, speculations, or persons. If it's there all the time, what's the point of introducing it specifically into some stories? Good question. I think it's a matter of shading and subtlety, and their opposite. It's a little like music, I suppose. Do you get all those musical jokes in Mozart and Haydn? Well, neither do I. The closest I came to classical music in my youth was Procol Harum ripping off a Bach cantata for A Whiter Shade of Pale. Eventually I learned a little, including the difference between Beethoven and Roll Over Beethoven, even if I prefer the latter, and between Miles Davis and John Coltrane at their peak, but I remain a musical numbskull. Those subtle jokes for the musical initiates are lost on an ignoramus such as myself. So if you want me to get the point musically, you'd better be fairly obvious. I get Keith Emerson better than I get Bach, any Bach, and some of the Bachs aren't that subtle. Same with literature. If writers want us, all of us, to notice something, they'd better put it out there where we'll find it. Please observe that in most works where blindness is manifest, the writer brings it up pretty early. I call this the Indiana Jones principle. If you want your audience to know something important about your character or the work at large, introduce it early, before you need it. Say we're 2/3 of the way through Raiders of the Lost Ark, and suddenly Indy, who has heretofore been afraid of absolutely nothing, is terrified of snakes. Do we buy that? Of course not. That's why Steven Spielberg, the director, and Lawrence Kasdan, the writer, installed that snake in the airplane right in the first sequence before the credits, so that when we get to the 7,000 snakes, we'll know just how badly they frighten our hero. The principle doesn't always work, of course. In his absurdist dramatic masterpiece, Waiting for Godot, 1954, about which, more later, Samuel Beckett waits until the second act to introduce a blind character. The first time Lucky and Pozzo show up to relieve the boredom of Didi and Gogo, the main characters, Pozzo is a cruel master who keeps Lucky on a leash. The second time, he's blind and needs Lucky to escort him around, although he's no less cruel for all that. Of course, what this means is up for grabs, since Beckett is employing irony, and not very subtly. More commonly, though, the blind character will show up early. In Henry Green's first novel, Blindness, 1926, his schoolboy protagonist is blinded by a freak accident when a small boy throws a rock through a railway carriage window. John, the schoolboy, has just begun to see life's possibilities, and at that moment in his life, a rock and 1,000 shards of glass come sailing in to rob him of that vision. Back to Oedipus. Don't feel too bad. When we meet him again, in Oedipus at Colonus, it's many years later, and of course he suffered greatly, but that suffering has redeemed him in the eyes of the gods, and rather than being a blight on the human landscape, he becomes a favorite of the gods, who welcome him into the next world with a miraculous death. He has acquired a level of vision he never had when he was sighted. Blind as he is, he walks toward that death without assistance, as if guided by an unseen power. Chapter 23. It's never just heart disease. One of my very favorite novels is a gem of narrative misdirection by Ford Madox Ford called The Good Soldier, 1915. Its narrator is more fallible, more consistently clueless than any narrator you're ever likely to meet in all of fiction. At the same time, he's completely believable and therefore pathetic. He is part of a pair of couples who meet every year at a European spa. During all these years, and quite unbeknownst to him, his wife, Florence, and the husband of the other couple, Edward Ashburnham, carry on a passionate affair. It gets better. Edward's wife, Leonora, knows all about it, and in fact may have stage-managed its beginning to keep the chronically straying Edward out of a more disastrous relationship. The success of this strategy must be questioned, since the relationship eventually manages to destroy, by my count, 6 lives. Only poor, cuckolded old John Dowell remains ignorant. Consider the possibilities for irony. For an English professor, and for any avid reader, having a blithely ignorant and only recently clued-in husband narrate the saga of his wife's longtime infidelity is about as good as it gets. But I digress. Why, you ask, are they habitués of the spa? Florence and Edward are ill, of course. Heart trouble. What else? In literature, there is no better, no more lyrical, no more perfectly metaphorical illness than heart disease. In real life, heart disease is none of the above. It's frightening, sudden, shattering, exhausting, but not lyrical or metaphorical. When the novelist or playwright employs it, however, we don't complain that he's being unrealistic or insensitive. Why? It's fairly straightforward. Aside from being the pump that keeps us alive, the heart is also, and has been since ancient times, the symbolic repository of emotion. In both the Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer has characters say of other characters that they have a heart of iron, iron being the newest and hardest metal known to man of the late Bronze Age. The meaning, if we allow for some slight variations of context, is tough-minded, resolute, even to the point of hard-heartedness. In other words, just what we might mean by the same statements today. Sophocles uses the heart to mean the center of emotion within the body, as do Dante, Shakespeare, Donne, Marvel, Hallmark, all the great writers. Despite this nearly constant use over at least 2,800 years, the figure of the heart never overstays its welcome, because it always is welcome. Writers use it because we feel it. What shapes were your Valentine's cards in when you were a kid? Or last year, for that matter? When we fall in love, we feel it in our hearts. When we lose a love, we feel heartbroken. When overwhelmed by strong emotion, we feel our hearts are full to bursting. Everybody knows this. Everybody intuitively senses this. What, then, can the writer do with this knowledge? The writer can use heart ailments as a kind of shorthand for the character, which is probably what happens most often, or he can use it as a social metaphor. The afflicted character can have any number of problems for which heart disease provides a suitable emblem. Bad love, loneliness, cruelty, pederasty, disloyalty, cowardice, lack of determination. Socially, it may stand for these matters on a larger scale, or for something seriously amiss at the heart of things. We're not just talking classic literature here. When Colin Dexter decides to kill off his recurrent Detective Morse in The Remorseful Day, 1999, he has a number of options. The chief inspector is a genius at solving crimes and crossword puzzles, but like all geniuses, he has flaws. Specifically, he drinks too much, and remains a complete stranger to physical fitness, so much so that in novel after novel, his Thames Valley Police superiors mention his excessive fondness for the beer. His liver and digestive system are seriously compromised, to the point where he is hospitalized for these problems in a previous Morse novel. In fact, he solves a century-old murder from his hospital bed in The Wench is Dead, 1989. His major problem, though, is loneliness. Morse has spectacularly bad luck with his women. Several wind up as either corpses or culprits in his various adventures, while others just don't work out. Sometimes he's too needy, other times too unbending, but time after time, he loses out. So when the time comes for him to collapse amid the spires of his beloved Oxford University, Dexter gives him a heart attack. Why? We're into the realm of speculation here, but this is how it strikes me. To have Morse succumb to cirrhosis of the liver turns the whole thing into a straightforward piece of moralizing. See, we told you drinking too much is bad for you. Morse's drinking would go from being a quaint idiosyncrasy to something from one of those old school guidance films, and that is not what Dexter wants. Of course, excessive drinking is bad for you. Excessive anything, including irony, is bad for you. But that's not the point. But with a heart attack, the connection to an over-fondness for drink is still there, if that's what some readers want to see. But now the ailment points not toward his behavior, but toward the pain and suffering, the loneliness and regret of his sad sack love life that may well be causing the behavior. The emphasis is on his humanity, not his misdeeds. And authors, as a rule, are chiefly interested in their character's humanity. Even when the humanity isn't very humane, or the heart ailment a disease, Nathaniel Hawthorne has a great short story called The Man of Adamant, 1837. As with a number of his characters, the man of the title is a committed misanthrope, absolutely convinced that everyone else is a sinner. So he moves into a cave to avoid all human contact. Does it sound like a heart problem to you? Of course it does. Now the limestone cave he chooses has water, a little drip of water that's just stiff with calcium. And moment by moment, year by year, the water in that cave seeps its way into his body, so that at the end of the story, he turns to stone. Or not him entirely, just his heart. The man whose heart was figurative stone at the outset has his heart turned to literal stone at the end. It's perfect. Or take the case of Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim. Early in the novel, Jim's courage has failed him at a crucial moment. His strength of heart, both in terms of bravery and of forming serious attachments, is in question throughout the narrative, at least in his own mind. And at the end, he misjudges an enemy, and his miscalculation causes the death of his best friend, who happens to be the son of the local chieftain. Jim has promised this leader, Doramin, that if his plan results in the death of any of his people, Jim will forfeit his own life. When it does, he walks with great calm to Doramin, who shoots him through the chest. Jim glances proudly at the assembled crowd. "See, I am both brave and true to my word," and falls dead. Conrad doesn't perform a post-mortem, but there is one and only one place in the chest where a shot results in instantaneous death. And we know where that place is. The very next comment by Marlowe, the narrator, is that Jim was inscrutable at heart. The novel's all about heart, really. Heart in all its senses. Jim's end, then, like the adamantine man's, is perfectly apt. A man who in life has put so much stock in heart, in loyalty and trust, in courage and fidelity, in having a true heart, can only die by a blow to the heart. Unlike Hawthorne's character's demise, though, Jim's is also heartbreaking. To the woman who is his de facto wife, to old Stein, the traitor who sent him in country, and to readers who come to hope for something heroic and uplifting, something suitably romantic for the incorrigibly romantic Jim. Conrad knows better, though. It's tragedy, not epic, as he proves by that shot in the heart. More commonly, though, heart trouble takes the form of heart disease. Vladimir Nabokov created one of the nastiest villains in modern literature in Lolita's Humbert Humbert. His self-absorption and obsession lead him to cruelty, statutory rape, murder, and the destruction of several lives. His darling Dolores, the Lolita of the title, can never lead a psychologically or spiritually whole adult life. Of her two seducers, Claire Quilty is dead, and Humbert is in jail, where he dies, somewhat unexpectedly, of heart failure. Throughout the whole novel, he's had a defective heart in the figurative sense, so how else could he die? He may or may not need to die, but if he does buy the farm, there's only one death symbolically appropriate to his situation. Nobody had to tell that to Nabokov. As a practical matter, then, we readers can play this two ways. If heart trouble shows up in a novel or play, we start looking for its signification, and we usually don't have to hunt too hard. The other way around, if we see that characters have difficulties of the heart, we won't be too surprised when emotional trouble becomes the physical ailment and the cardiac episode appears. Now, about that irony. Remember Florence and Edward, the wayward spouses with heart trouble? Just what, you ask, is wrong with their hearts? Not a thing in the world. Physically, that is. Faithlessness, selfishness, cruelty, those things are wrong, and ultimately those things kill them. But physically, their hearts are completely sound. So why did I say earlier they suffer from heart disease? Haven't I just violated the principle of this chapter? Not really. Their choice of illness is quite telling. Each of them elects to employ a fragile heart as a device to deceive the respective spouse, to be able to construct an elaborate personal fiction based on heart disease, to announce to the world that he or she suffers from a bad heart. And in each case, the lie is, on another level, absolutely true. As I said earlier, it doesn't get better than that. Chapter 24. And Rarely Just Illness. At the beginning of James Joyce's wonderful story, The Sisters, 1914, the unnamed young narrator mentions that his old friend and mentor, a priest, is dying. There is no hope for him this time, we're told. Already your reader's radar should be on full alert. A priest with no hope? Not hard to recognize in such a statement a host of possibilities for interpretive play, and indeed those possibilities are realized throughout the story. What's of immediate interest here, though, is how the priest got that way. He's had a stroke, not his first, and it has left him paralyzed. Paralysis is a word that fascinates the young boy, quite apart from its meaning. He yokes it with simony and gnomon in a triad of words to obsess over. For us, however, it's the notion of paralysis and stroke that intrigues. Anyone who has ever had to watch a loved one deteriorate after a massive stroke will no doubt look askance at the very idea of such frustration and misery being in some way intriguing, fascinating, or picturesque, and quite rightly. But as we've seen time and again, what we feel in real life and what we feel in our reading lives can be quite different. In this instance, our interest is not in the deterioration of the old priest, but in what his condition is telling us about him, about the boy, about the story at large, and about Joyce's collection, Dubliners, in which it is the first piece. The boy has witnessed James, the priest, begin the slow decline after earlier strokes, his clothing covered with bits of tobacco and ash, his movement awkward, his speech affected. But it's the paralysis after the recent massive stroke that commands the boy's attention. Within the story, the paralysis shows up in several ways, not least of them a sort of madness that set in at the time the priest was relieved of his parish over some incident involving an acolyte. All references to the event are sidelong and somewhat secretive, with shame a distinct component of James's and his sister's responses. Whether the matter involved sexual impropriety or something to do with a litany, we never learn. Only that James was found in the confessional laughing softly and talking to himself. That he spent his last years a virtual recluse in a back room of his sister's house indicates the degree to which emotional or mental paralysis had already set in before his stroke. From this little story, the condition of paralysis grows into one of Joyce's great themes. Dublin is a city in which the inhabitants are paralyzed by the strictures laid upon them by church, state, and convention. We see it throughout Dubliners. A girl who cannot let go of the railing to board a ship with her lover. Men who know the right thing to do but fail because their bad habits limit their ability to act in their own best interest. A man confined to bed after a drunken fall in a public house restroom. Political activists who fail to act after the death of their great leader, Charles Stuart Parnell, some 10 years earlier. It shows up again and again in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Ulysses, and even in Finnegan's Wake, 1939. Of course, most maladies in most short stories or even novels are not quite so productive of meaning. For Joyce, however, paralysis, physical, moral, social, spiritual, intellectual, political, informs his whole career. Until the 20th century, disease was mysterious. Folks began to comprehend the germ theory of disease in the 19th century, of course, after Louis Pasteur, but until they could do something about it, until the age of inoculation, illness remained frightening and mysterious. People sickened and died, often with no discernible preamble. You went out in the rain, 3 days later you had pneumonia. Ergo, rain and chills caused pneumonia. That still occurs, of course. If you're like me, you were told over and over again as a child to button your coat and put on a hat lest you catch your death of cold. We've never really accepted microbes into our lives. Even knowing how disease is transmitted, we remain largely superstitious. And since illness is so much a part of life, so too it is a part of literature. There are certain principles governing the use of disease in works of literature. 1. Not all diseases are created equal. Prior to modern sanitation and enclosed water systems in the 20th century, cholera was nearly as common as, much more aggressive than, and more devastating than tuberculosis, which was generally called consumption. Yet cholera doesn't come close to TB in its frequency of literary occurrence. Why? Image, mostly. Cholera has a bad reputation, and there's almost nothing the best public relations firm in the world could do to improve it. It's ugly. Horrible. Death by cholera is unsightly, painful, smelly, and violent. In that same period of the late 19th century, syphilis and gonorrhea reached near epidemic proportions. Yet, except for Henrik Ibsen and some of the later naturalists, venereal diseases were hardly on the literary map. Syphilis, of course, was, prima facie, evidence of sex beyond the bounds of marriage, of moral corruption. You could only get it, supposedly, by visiting prostitutes, and therefore taboo. In its tertiary stages, of course, it also produced unpleasant results, including loss of control of one's limbs, the sudden spastic motions Kurt Vonnegut writes of in his 1973 Breakfast of Champions, and madness. The only treatment known to the Victorians employed mercury, which turned the gums and saliva black and carried its own hazards. So these two, despite their widespread occurrence, were never A-list diseases. Well then, what makes a prime literary disease? 2. It should be picturesque. What, you don't think illness is picturesque? Consider consumption. Of course, it's awful when a person has a coughing fit that sounds like he's trying to bring up a whole lung, but the sufferer of tuberculosis often acquires a sort of bizarre beauty. The skin becomes almost translucent, the eye sockets dark, so that the sufferer takes on the appearance of a martyr in medieval paintings. 3. It should be mysterious in origin. Again, consumption was a clear winner, at least with the Victorians. The awful disease sometimes swept through whole families, as it would when one member nursed a dying parent or sibling or child, coming into daily contact with contaminated droplets, phlegm, blood for an extended period. The mode of transmission, however, remained murky for most people in that century. Certainly John Keats had no idea that caring for his brother Tom was sealing his own doom, any more than the Brontes knew what hit them. That love and tenderness should be rewarded with a lengthy fatal illness was beyond ironic. By the middle of the 19th century, science discovered that cholera and bad water went together, so it had no mystery points. As for syphilis, well, its origins were entirely too clear. 4. It should have strong symbolic or metaphorical possibilities. If there's a metaphor connected with smallpox, I don't want to know about it. Smallpox was hideous in both the way it presented and the disfigurement it left without really offering any constructive symbolic possibilities. Tuberculosis, on the other hand, was a wasting disease, both in terms of the individual wasting away, growing thinner and thinner, and in terms of the waste of lives that were often barely underway. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, TB joined cancer in dominating the literary imagination regarding illness. Here's a partial list. Ralph Touchette in Henry James' novel The Portrait of a Lady, 1881, and Millie Thiele in his later The Wings of the Dove, 1902. Little Eva in Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, 1852. Paul Dombey in Charles Dickens' Dombey and Son, 1848. Mimi in Puccini's opera La Bohème, 1896. Hans Castorp and his fellow patients at the sanatorium in Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, 1924. Michael Fury in Joyce's The Dead. Eugene Gant's father in Thomas Wolfe's Of Time and the River, 1935. And Rupert Birkin in Lawrence's Women in Love. In fact, Lawrence encodes his illness into the physiognomy, personality, and general health of his various alter egos. Not every one of these was labeled tubercular. Some were delicate, fragile, sensitive, wasting away. Others were said to have a lung or suffer from lung disease, or were merely identified as having a persistent cough or periods of low energy. A mere symptom or two would suffice for the contemporary audience to whom the symptoms were all too familiar. So many characters contracted tuberculosis in part because so many writers either suffered from it themselves or watched friends, colleagues, and loved ones deteriorate in its grasp. In addition to Keats and the Brontes, Robert Louis Stevenson, Catherine Mansfield, Lawrence, Frederick Chopin, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Franz Kafka, and Percy Bysshe Shelley form a fair beginning toward a who's who of artistic consumptives. In her study, Illness as a Metaphor, 1977, Susan Sontag brilliantly discusses the reasons for the disease's popularity as a subject and the metaphorical uses to which it was put. For now, we're less interested in all the implications she identifies and more interested in recognizing that when a writer employs TB directly or indirectly, he's making a statement about the victim of the disease. His choice, while no doubt carrying a strong element of verisimilitude, also very likely houses symbolic or metaphorical intentions. This fourth consideration, the metaphorical possibilities a disease offers, generally overrides all others. A sufficiently compelling metaphor can induce an author to bring an otherwise objectionable illness into a work. A good example would be plague. As an instance of individual suffering, bubonic plague is no bonus, but in terms of widespread societal devastation, it's a champion. In two works written a mere 2,500 years apart, plague successfully takes center stage. In Oedipus Rex, Sophocles has Thebes hit by various plagues, withered crops, stillborn children, the works. But here, as in general use, plague carries with it the implication of bubonic. It comes to mean what we think of as plague, in fact, because it can lay waste to whole cities in short order, because it sweeps through populations as a visitation of divine wrath. And of course, divine wrath is the order of the day at the beginning of Sophocles' play. 2.5 millennia later, Albert Camus not only uses plague, he calls his novel The Plague, 1947. Again, he is not interested so much in the individual sufferer as he is in the communal aspect and the philosophical possibilities. In examining how a person confronts the wholesale devastation wrought by disease, Camus can set his existentialist philosophy into motion in a fictional setting. The isolation and uncertainty caused by the disease, the absurdly random nature of infection, the despair felt by a doctor in the face of an unstoppable epidemic, the desire to act even while recognizing the pointlessness of action. Now, neither Camus's nor Sophocles' use is particularly subtle or hard to get, but in their overt way, they teach us how other writers may use illness when it is less central. When Henry James has had enough of Daisy Miller and decides to kill her off, he gives her Roman fever, or what we would now call malaria. If you read that beautiful little novella and neither of these names suggests anything to you, you really need to pay more attention. Malaria works great, metaphorically. It translates as bad air. Daisy has suffered from figurative bad air, malicious gossip, and hostile public opinion throughout her stay in Rome. As the name implies, it was formerly thought that the illness was contracted from harmful vapors in hot, moist night air. No one suspected that the problem might lie with those darned mosquitoes that were biting them on those hot, moist nights. So the notion of poisonous vapors would work nicely. Still, the older name used by James, Roman fever, is even better. Daisy does indeed suffer from Roman fever, from the overheated state that makes her frantic to join the elite. "We're dying to be exclusive," she says early on, while at the same time causing the disapproval of the Europeanized Americans who reside permanently in Rome at every turn. When she makes her fatal midnight trip to the Colosseum and sees the object of, if not her affections, then at least her interests, Winterbourne, he ignores her, prompting her to say, "He cuts me dead." And the next thing we know, she is dead. Does the manner of her death matter? Of course. Roman fever perfectly captures what happens to Daisy, this fresh young thing from the wilds of Schenectady who is destroyed by the clash between her own vitality and the rotten atmosphere of this oldest of old world cities. James is a literary realist, hardly the most flamboyantly symbolic of writers, but when he can kill off a character in a highly lifelike way while employing an apt metaphor for her demise, he doesn't hesitate. Another great 19th century realist who sees the figurative value of illness is Henrik Ibsen. In his breakthrough play, A Doll's House, 1879, he includes a neighbor to the Helmer family, Dr. Rank, who is dying of tuberculosis of the spine. Dr. Rank's illness is uncommon only in terms of its location in the body, although the respiratory system is the one we always think of. Here's the interesting part. Rank says he inherited the disease from his father's dissolute living. Aha! Now, instead of being a mere ailment, his condition becomes an indictment of parental misdeeds, a strong thematic statement in its own right, and as we latter-day cynics can recognize, a coded reference to an entirely different pair of letters. Not TB, but VD. As I suggested earlier, syphilis and its various brethren were off-limits for most of the 19th century, so any references needed to be in code, as here. How many people suffer from consumption because their parents led immoral lives? Some, certainly, but inherited syphilis is much more likely. In fact, emboldened by his experiment here, Ibsen returned to the notion several years later in Ghosts, 1881, in which he has a young man losing his mind as the result of inherited tertiary syphilis. Intergenerational tensions, responsibilities, and misdeeds are some of Ibsen's abiding themes, so it's not surprising that such an ailment would resonate with him. Naturally, what gets encoded in a literary disease is largely up to the writer and the reader. When, in the course of Justine, the first novel of Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet, the narrator's lover, Melissa, succumbs to tuberculosis, he means something very different from what Ibsen means. Melissa, the dancer, slash escort, slash prostitute, is a victim of life. Poverty, neglect, abuse, exploitation have all combined to grind her down. And the grinding nature of her illness, and of Darley's, the narrator's, inability to save her or even to recognize his responsibilities to her, stands as the physical expression of the way life and men have quite literally used her up. Moreover, her own acceptance of the disease, of the inevitability of her mortality and suffering, mirrors her self-sacrificing nature. Perhaps it is best for everyone else, Darley especially, if she dies. What's best for her never seems to enter her mind. In the third novel of the series, Mount Olive, Leila Hosnani contracts smallpox, which she takes as a sign of divine judgment against her vanity and her marital lapse. Durrell, however, sees it otherwise, as symptomatic of the ravages that time and living take on us all. In each case, of course, we're free to draw our own conclusions. What about AIDS? Every age has its special disease. The Romantics and Victorians had consumption. We have AIDS. For a while in the middle of the 20th century, it looked like polio would be the disease of the century. Everyone knew people who died, or wound up on crutches, or lived in iron lungs because of that terrible and terrifying disease. Although I was born the year Dr. Jonas Salk made his blessed discovery of a vaccine, I can remember parents during my youth who still wouldn't let their children go into a public swimming pool. Even when conquered, polio had a powerful grip on the imaginations of my parents' generation. For some reason, though, that imagination did not become literary. Polio rarely shows up in novels of the period. Now, AIDS, on the other hand, has been an epidemic that does occupy the writers of its time. Why? Let's run the list. Picturesque? Certainly not. But it shares that terrible, dramatic, wasting quality of consumption. Mysterious? It was when it showed up. And even now, this virus that can mutate in infinite ways to thwart nearly any treatment eludes our efforts to corral it. Symbolic? Most definitely. AIDS is the motherlode of symbol and metaphor. Its tendency to lie dormant for so long, then make an appearance. Its ability, because of that dormant period, to turn every victim into an unknowing carrier. Its virtual 100% mortality rates over the first decade or so of its history. All these things offer strong symbolic possibilities. The way it has visited itself disproportionately on young people, hit the gay community so hard, devastated so many people in the developing world, been a scourge in artistic circles, the tragedy and despair, but also the courage and resilience and compassion, or their lack, have provided metaphor, theme, and symbol as well as plot and situation for our writers. Because of the demographic distribution of its infection history, AIDS adds another property to its literary usage, the political angle. Nearly everybody who wants to can find something in HIV/AIDS that somehow works into their political view. Social and religious conservatives almost immediately saw the element of divine retribution, while AIDS activists saw the slow response of government as evidence of official hostility to ethnic and sexual constituencies hardest hit by the disease. That's a lot of freight for a disease which is really just about transmission, incubation, and duration, which is what all diseases have always been about. Given the highly charged nature of the public experience, we would expect to see AIDS show up in places occupied by other ailments in earlier times. Michael Cunningham's novel, The Hours, 1998, is a reworking of Virginia Woolf's modern classic, Mrs. Dalloway, in which a shell-shocked veteran of the Great War disintegrates and commits suicide. In the aftermath of that terrible war, shell shock was a hot-button medical item. Did it exist? Were these men simply malingerers? Were they predisposed to psychological unfitness? Could they be cured? What had they seen that caused them but not others to succumb? With each modern war, the term has changed, from shell shock to battle fatigue in World War II and Korea to post-traumatic stress disorder in Vietnam, and each time the illness has had its believers and its detractors. In a bizarre twist, the Gulf War syndrome, which seemed to be physiological in nature, was dismissed by authorities as simply a modern version of shell shock. These would be the same authorities, of course, who in that earlier age would have denied that shell shock existed. Cunningham clearly can't use shell shock, and is even too far out of the Vietnam era for PTSD to have much resonance. Besides, he's writing about the contemporary urban experience, as Woolf was doing earlier in the century. And part of that experience for him is the gay and lesbian community, and part of that experience is HIV/AIDS. His suicide, therefore, is a patient with very advanced AIDS. Other than the illness that occasions them, the two deaths resemble each other greatly. We recognize in them a personal calamity that is particular to its time, but that has the universality of great suffering and despair and courage, of a victim seeking to wrest control over his own life away from the condition that has controlled him. It's a situation, Cunningham reminds us, that differs from age to age only in the specific details, not in the humanity those details reveal. That's what happens when works get re-envisioned. We learn something about the age that produced the original, as well as about our own. Often, though, the most effective illness is the one the writer makes up. Fever, the non-Roman sort, worked like a charm in times past. The character merely contracted fever, took to her bed, and died in short or long order, as the plot demanded, and there you were. The fever could represent the randomness of fate, the harshness of life, the unknowability of the mind of God, the playwright's lack of imagination, any of a wide array of possibilities. Dickens kills off all sorts of characters with fevers that don't get identified. Of course, he had so many characters that he needed to dispatch some of them periodically just for housekeeping purposes. Poor little Paul Dombey succumbs with the sole purpose of breaking his father's heart. Little Nell hovers between life and death for an unbearable real-time month as readers of the original serialized version waited for the next installment to be issued and reveal her fate. Edgar Allan Poe, who in real life saw plenty of tuberculosis, gives us a mystery disease in The Mask of the Red Death. It may be an encoding of TB or of some other malady, but chiefly it is what no real disease can ever be, exactly what the author wants it to be. Real illnesses come with baggage, which can be useful or at least overcome in a novel. A made-up illness, though, can say whatever its maker wants it to say. It's too bad modern writers lost the generic fever and the mystery malady when modern medicine got so it could identify virtually any microbe and thereby diagnose virtually any disease. This strikes me as a case where the cure is definitely worse than the disease, at least for literature. Chapter 25. Don't read with your eyes. Remember the 12th night party in Joyce's story, The Dead, that we looked at earlier? To a child of late 20th century America, or early 21st for that matter, the meal is no big deal, except for the goose. Not that many households in this country roast a goose for the holiday, or any holiday. But the rest looks pretty ordinary to us. A vase with stalks of celery, American apples and oranges on the sideboard, flowery potatoes. Nothing very remarkable, unless you live, as do the old ladies who provide the meal, in pre-electrification Dublin, where it happens to be the 6th of January. So if you're going to understand the ladies and the meal and the story, you have to read through eyes that are not your own, eyes that, while not those of Aunts Kate and Julia, can take in the meaning of the meal they have provided. And those eyes did not grow up watching Animaniacs. The ants have provided a meal beyond their limited means, in which they feed exotic and expensive produce to a substantial number of guests. Celery does not grow in Ireland in January, and the fruit is from America, and therefore quite expensive. They have gone to considerable expense on Epiphany, the second most important day of the Christmas season, the day the Christ child was revealed to the wise men. In addition to its religious significance, the evening is also the old lady's one big extravagance of the year, the party by which they cling to a fading gentility and memories of greater comfort as members of the middle class. We cannot understand their anxiety over the success of this gathering unless we see how important it is in their lives. Or take this situation. James Baldwin's wonderful short story, Sonny's Blues, deals with a rather uptight math teacher in Harlem in the 1950s, whose brother serves time in prison for heroin possession. At the end of the story, there's a scene we looked at in an earlier chapter, where the brother, Sonny, has returned to playing in a club, and the math teacher, our narrator, goes to hear him for the first time ever. There's been a lot of tension throughout the story since the two don't comprehend each other, and the math teacher really can't fathom the troubles that drive Sonny and his music and his drug problem. Nor does he understand jazz. The only jazz name he can come up with is Louis Armstrong, proving to Sonny that he's hopelessly square. As the brother sits listening to Sonny with the jazz combo, however, he begins to hear in this beautiful, troubled music the depths of feeling and suffering and joy that lie behind it. So he sends an offering, a scotch and milk, that indicates understanding and brotherhood. Sonny sips, sets the drink back on the piano, and acknowledges the gift, which shimmers like the very cup of trembling in the closing words of the story. It's deep and emotional and biblical, with a resonance that very few stories ever achieve, about as close to perfection as we're likely to encounter. Now here's where the business of interpretation gets interesting. At my school, there are sociology/social work classes on substance abuse. And two or three times I've had a recent student in said substance abuse classes show up at discussions of Sonny's Blues very earnestly saying something like, "You should never give alcohol to a recovering addict." Perfectly true, I'm sure. In this context, though, not helpful. This story was published in 1957, using the best information Baldwin had at that time, and it is meant as a study of relations between brothers, not as a treatise on addiction. It's about redemption, not recovery. If you read it as the latter, that is, if you don't adjust your eyes and mind to transport you from contemporary reality to Baldwin's 1957, whatever the ending has to offer will be pretty well lost on you. We all have our own blind spots, and that's normal. We expect a certain amount of verisimilitude, of faithfulness to the world we know, in what we watch and what we read. On the other hand, a too rigid insistence on the fictive world corresponding on all points to the world we know can be terribly limiting, not only to our enjoyment, but to our understanding of literary works. So how much is too much? What can we reasonably demand of our reading? That's up to you. But I'll tell you what I think, and what I try to do. It seems to me that if we want to get the most out of our reading, as far as is reasonable, we have to try to take the works as they were intended to be taken. The formula I generally offer is this: don't read with your eyes. What I really mean is, don't read only from your own fixed position in the year of our Lord 2000 and some. Instead, try to find a reading perspective that allows for sympathy with the historical moment of the story, that understands the text as having been written against its own social, historical, cultural, and personal background. There are dangers in this, and I'll return to them. I also need to acknowledge here that there is a different model of professional reading, deconstruction, that pushes skepticism and doubt to its extreme, questioning nearly everything in the story or poem at hand, to deconstruct the work and show how the author is not really in charge of his materials. The goal of these deconstructive readings is to demonstrate how the work is controlled and reduced by the values and prejudices of its own time. As you will have discerned, this is an approach with which I have limited sympathy. At the end of the day, I prefer to like the works I analyze, but that's another story. Let's return for a moment to Baldwin's math teacher and Sonny's addiction. The comment about giving alcohol to an addict betrays a certain mindset about social problems, as well as a unique history of artistic and popular culture experiences on the part of the reader that are at odds with the story's own goals. Sonny's Blues is about redemption, but not the one students have been conditioned to expect. So much of our popular culture, daytime talk shows, made-for-television movies, magazine articles, leads us to think in terms of identifying a problem, such as addiction, and seeking a simple, direct solution. In its place, such thinking makes perfect sense. On the other hand, Baldwin is only slightly interested in Sonny's addiction in and of itself. What he really cares about is the brother's emotional turmoil. Everything in the story points to this interest. The point of view, the brothers, the depth of detail about the brother's life relative to Sonny's, the direct access to the brother's thoughts, all remind us this is about the narrator and not the jazz man. Most tellingly, it is the brother who is removed from his world, taken out of his comfort zone when he follows Sonny to meet with other musicians and then to hear Sonny play. If you want to put pressure on a character to cause him to change or crumble, take him away from home, make him inhabit an alien world. For the middle-class math teacher, the world of jazz might as well be Neptune. Here's why this business of the reader's perspective matters. This story falls into that very large category that I call last chance for change stories. Not a terribly scientific name, I'll grant, but that's what they are. Here's how they work. The character, sufficiently old to have experienced a number of opportunities to grow, to reform, to get it right, but of course he never has, is presented with one more chance, one last opportunity to educate himself in this most important area, and it varies with the story, where up to now he has remained stunted. The reason he's older is just the opposite of why the quester is typically younger. His possibilities for growth are limited, and time is running out. In other words, there is a time imperative, a sort of urgency as the sands run out. And then the situation in which he finds himself needs to be compelling. Our guy? He's never understood or sympathized with his brother, even to the point of not visiting him in prison. When the narrator's daughter dies and Sonny writes a caring letter of sympathy, he makes the narrator, I'm sorry he doesn't have a name, feel even greater guilt. Now that Sonny is out of prison and not using heroin, the narrator has a chance to get to know his younger, troubled brother as he never has before. If he can't do that this time, he never will. And this leads us to the point of the last chance for change story, which is always the same. Can this person be saved? This is the question Baldwin is asking in the story, but he's not asking it about Sonny. In fact, such is the heartlessness of authors, for the question to really matter to us in terms of the narrator, Sonny's own future must be very cloudy. Whether he can do the one thing in the world he's good at and not be drawn back into the addiction that is rife within the jazz community, we cannot know. Our doubts on his behalf add to the urgency of the narrator's growth. Anyone can love and understand a reformed junkie, but one who may not be reformed, who admits the perils are still there for him, offers real difficulties. Now, if we read the story through the filter of daytime talk shows and social work classes, we not only miss the focus of the story, we misunderstand it at its most basic level. Sonny's trouble is interesting, of course, but it's merely the hook to draw us in. The real issues the story raises all concern the narrator slash brother. If we see it as Sonny's story, the resolution will be profoundly dissatisfying. If we understand it as the brothers, it works beautifully. And this is a fairly recent story. How much harder to understand the mindset behind, say, Moby Dick, The Last of the Mohicans, The Iliad, all that violence, a diet that is almost purely carnivorous, blood sacrifices, looting, multiple gods, concubines? Those readers who have been raised in a monotheistic culture, which is all of us, whatever our religious persuasion or lack thereof, who live within the Western tradition, might have a little trouble with the piety of the Greeks, whose chief implement of religious practice is the carving knife. Indeed, the very setup of the epic, in which Achilles throws a fit and withdraws from the war because his sex slave has been taken from him, does not engage our sympathies as it would have those of the ancient Greek audience. For that matter, his redemption, in which he proves he's back on track by slaughtering every Trojan in sight, strikes us as distinctly barbaric. So what can this great work, and its spirituality, sexual politics, code of machismo, and overwrought violence teach us? Plenty, if we're willing to read with the eyes of a Greek. A really, really old Greek. Achilles destroys the thing he holds most dear, his lifelong friend Patroclus, and dooms himself to an early death by allowing excessive pride to overrule his judgment. Even great men must learn to bend. Anger is unbecoming. One day our destiny will come for us, and even the gods can't stop it. There are lots of useful lessons in the Iliad, but while it may at times read like an episode of the Jerry Springer Show, we'll miss most of them if we read it through the lens of our own popular culture. Now, about that danger I mentioned earlier. Too much acceptance of the author's viewpoint can lead to difficulties. Do we have to accept the values of a 3,000-year-old blood culture as depicted in the Homeric epics? Absolutely not. I think we should frown on the wanton destruction of societies, on the enslavement of conquered peoples, on keeping concubines, on wholesale slaughter. At the same time, though, we need to understand that the Mycenaean Greeks did not. So if we